This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodl Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Joining me today is Dr. Jay Fahey from the University of Leicester, whose research is onto white dwarfs and has found some really cool results from these. So let's take it away, Jay.
White dwarfs are the end state of stars. They're like the death of stars, we often say. Supernovae and black holes and white dwarfs are the three possibilities for the death of stars. But white dwarfs are what happen 99% of the time. Supernovae and black holes are very exciting, but they happen very rarely in our galaxy and in the universe at large. So the fate of most stars in our galaxy will be to become white dwarfs eventually, and in fact that's what our sun will be one day. And I'm trying to answer the question of what will planetary systems like ours look like when they get to the white dwarf stage.
So you have detected some metals, and then metals mean anything sort of not hydrogen or helium in astronomical terms, through these white dwarfs. Can you tell us a bit about this and what this means for the fate of our solar system?
Well, theoretically, some time ago, people figured out that because white dwarfs are, they're Earth-sized, but they contain about a sun's worth of mass in this kind of compact Earth-shaped body or Earth-sized body, it leads to very high gravity. So if you were standing on the surface of the white dwarf, the gravity that you would feel would be 100,000 times stronger than the Earth. So what happens is if you drop some elements heavier than hydrogen or helium, they sink really rapidly due to that strong gravity. And this, what essentially happens is after the stellar death and all the kind of leftover stuff from the planetary nebula phase, this all sinks away very quickly. And what we found is, surprisingly, a few hundred million years or billion years later into this white dwarf stage, we see the atmospheric signature of heavy elements or metals in their atmosphere. And it's surprising because they shouldn't be there. They should sink away. And so the fact that we see them tells us that something is putting them there. They're coming from the outside. They're not intrinsic to the star, because once they sink away, they can't come back up. So something's putting them there. And we initiated a program with the Spitzer Space Telescope several years ago to look for the culprit of the metal culprit, so to speak. And what we found is a significant portion of these white dwarfs with metals have rocky debris circling right on top of them, which we think is responsible for these heavy elements.
So where could this rocky debris come from?
Well, that's a good question. In fact, the debris we see around these stars, we call them debris disks or, dust disks. And these are known at main sequence stars. For example, one of the brightest stars in the sky, Vega, is one of the first first stars known to have a debris disk. And the ones at white dwarfs are very different. At the main sequence stars, the dust disks are analogous to the Kuiper belt, so that they're, tens of AU away, tens of Earth-Sun distances away. They're generally cold dust belts, like our Kuiper belt. And the ones at white dwarfs are actually right on top of the star. The Earth-sized star, together with the dust around the white dwarf, is together smaller than our sun, roughly speaking. And so the dust is so close, it's very warm, and in order for that to get there, something has to have come very close to the star and become gravitationally torn apart. And the process is exactly analogous to Saturn's rings. So that Saturn's rings were formed when a proto-moon or a passing comet got too close to Saturn and gravity torn apart. And the way that happens is when you get really close to something, gravity will be stronger on the face of it than it is on the back of it. And that's just because gravity is a 1 over r squared law. And this is the same effect that happens between the Earth and the Moon. The tides are raised by the pull of the Moon on the Earth. And so we think something's come too close to the white dwarf and has been gravitationally shredded and has left this debris right on top of the star.
So what size of objects are we talking about? Are we talking about little asteroids? Are we talking bigger things? Are we talking about Pluto-y size? Objects.
Well, we think the best description right now is large asteroids, and that's things that are about 150 kilometers in diameter, possibly bigger. We don't have an accurate estimate of the masses, but we have good lower limits. And the lower limits in most cases are these kind of large asteroid size, 150 kilometer object. In a few cases, the object was probably at least as massive as Vesta in a few cases, which is the second largest asteroid in our solar system, and maybe in one or two cases as large as Ceres, which is the most massive asteroid. But these are the minimum masses, so these things could actually be bigger. They could be something like a moon or a major planet. We're not sure.
And do these systems, have you seen them all over the sky? Are they close by to us? Are this common?
Well, the nearest one is the nearest star, Alpha Centauri, is about roughly a parsec away. So the nearest white dwarf with dust is 14 times as far away. But we still consider that nearby. It's very far, of course, but 14 parsecs is the nearest one, and there are a few within 50 parsecs of the sun. It looks like they occur. Take a random white dwarf, you have a probability of a few percent of seeing a disk. So there are only about 100 white dwarfs within this kind of distance, and so we only know of a few. So only a few percent of them show it. So nearby, a few. A little bit further out, a few more.
So these white dwarf systems, they've had some big rocky bodies surrounding them that have been fallen in by gravity. The other type of white dwarfs, are these just not had the big rocky bodies around them?
Well, the disks that we see are certainly a lower limit to the systems which still have rocks around them or rocky objects, planets, moons. It's a lower limit because we only see those where the asteroid comes in and gets destroyed and gives us these signatures. So the ones with disks are only a couple of percent, but the ones polluted with metals are more like 20 to 30%. But again, that's still a lower limit to the systems which probably still have rocky planetary systems, because maybe some of them are out there and they just haven't had their asteroids thrown around within the last few years, so we don't see them. So, I mean, from a picture of terrestrial planet formation, I think the quick and dirty answer is at least 2% and possibly as many as 20 or 30% have rocky planetary systems. And the interesting thing is these white dwarfs have come from stars like our sun, a little bit more massive, a little bit, but not too much. And so what it's telling us is that between a few percent, but probably more like 20, 30% of stars similar to our sun form terrestrial planets. And the analogy is because the asteroids in our solar system are actually leftovers from terrestrial planet formation. And the main asteroid belt wanted to become a planet, a fifth terrestrial planet, but it couldn't because Jupiter's gravity is too strong. It keeps it. So if these are asteroid analogs, then they're telling us that terrestrial planets form at stars like our sun at least a few percent and probably a few tens of a percent of the time.
So Earth-like planets are common across our galaxy and possibly in other galaxies as well?
I would say so. I can't really comment on other galaxies, but I see no reason why other galaxies should be different than the Milky Way. And yes, I would say that conservatively, that Earth-like planets are built, you know, several percent of the time, and more likely a few tens of percent of the time. I mean, it's conservative to say that because that's what we have evidence for, but from a point of view of when stars form, you know, they have to shed 99% of their angular momentum. This is kind of like the ice skater analogy, you know, and you really, it seems hard to get around forming planets. But it's nice to, you know, not just make a hand-waving argument like that. We have rocky objects at least a few and probably a few tens of percent of white dwarfs, and that tells us that rocky planet formation is almost certainly common.
So something interesting you said today was that we should stop thinking about single stars and should start thinking about stars and the planets surrounding them, because that's going to have some effect at least. Maybe now with the new generation telescopes we may be able to see this better. Is that going to be the case?
Well, I think we're already seeing those kinds of things, but it's hard to give a it's hard to give some specific examples because it, sometimes it involves some technical stuff. But one of the things that I find interesting is that I kind of come from a background of learning about paradigm changes when I was in university. And I found this idea really interesting because it's, you know, people say these silly phrases like thinking out of the box. But this is a really big box whose walls we often don't see. And when you go to meetings and you talk to astronomers who've studied a certain thing their whole lives and they've just been accustomed to a way of thinking, and they say, well, we see this certain shape of gas and dust around a star, and, you know, we think there's a binary companion, so it's two...
So by binary you mean double
two
stars,
yeah. So they think it's two stars. And I say to them, I said, well, you know, why can't it be a planet? We know that these are really common now, and they've been thinking about binary stars, two stars, their whole career, and they've not even considered planets, even though now we've known about exoplanets planets for 15 years. And I just try to encourage them. It's like, well, stars almost certainly come with planets, and they may come with planets 100% of the time. And so I think it's time for people who study stars to start thinking about what the planetary system does.
That's really cool, what all these planets possibly to see. How long does it take for the debris to fall into the white dwarf from orbiting around?
We don't know. That's a common answer, but it's not a very helpful answer. We think that it could be a very long time. For example, Saturn's rings, there's a debate on the age of Saturn's rings, but one school of thought is that they could be ancient, meaning that they could be nearly as old as our planetary system, so on the order of 5 billion years. I tend to support that point of view because the starlight that hits Saturn's rings would cause a kind of a drag force or a damping force or slowing down of the particles orbiting Saturn's rings, and so they would kind of fall onto Saturn. You would think that's an one idea, but it turns out that Saturn's rings actually stop before Saturn's surface, and there's a gap there, and so that's as far as Saturn's rings have gotten to the surface of Saturn. They haven't fallen in as however old they are, and so we think it's a similar phenomenon at the disks of white dwarfs, as they act like planetary rings, and the light from a white dwarf is really feeble. They're really small and dim. And so we don't think the light drag is very strong. And so the only thing pushing them towards the surface is just kind of like billiard balls bouncing around. It's just rocks bumping into each other. And it's not a very strong force. So they actually could persist for millions of years. It's probably driven by however much material there is, and whatever rate they do fall on is just as long as it takes to eat it, that's how long they'll last. It's not a great answer, I know, but it could be millions of years, probably at least a few thousand.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you for joining us on the Jugcast. It's been great.
Thank you very much.